Authorities at Colorado State University say they want to keep concealed handguns off campus. That's the goal of a policy they approved. And now they face the complexities of doing that in a state where concealed weapons are allowed. Here's Grace Hood of member station KUNC.
Last December, Colorado State University's Board of Governors voted to ban concealed carry weapons on campus. At the time, the Associated Students of CSU were the lone voice of dissent. But recently, that opposition has gotten louder. At a press conference on the Fort Collins campus earlier this month, Terry Ryan of the advocacy group Rocky Mountain Gun Owners says the university policy would violate Colorado's concealed carry law.
If CSU persists in trying to ban firearms on this campus, a lawsuit will be filed.
Standing aside Ryan is the region's county sheriff, Jim Alderton. He says if the CSU policy is put into place, he will not jail anyone found guilty of violating it.
How does that work legally? I mean, aren't you required to enforce the law? Or?
What CSU is trying to pass is a policy, and their position is that the university policy trumps state law and the U.S. Constitution.
And you're saying?
Absolutely not.
Under Colorado law, campuses do have the authority to implement weapons control policies.
Brad Bolander is spokesman for Colorado State University.
That's been demonstrated previously by just about every other campus in the state.
Bolander says the ban won't go into place until a specific university policy is approved. So far, CSU officials have been poring through public comment on a draft of the plan. Right now, Colorado statute does not specifically address handguns on college campuses, and that's created some of the confusion in the CSU debate. Since the 2007 Virginia Tech shootings, vague legal language has been a source of debate in other states, too. Legislators have introduced 56 bills in the last 3 years aimed at specifically addressing concealed carry laws on college campuses, either to allow or restrict carry. That's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Vincent Bottolato is a policy analyst for the organization.
While there's a lot of talk about it, it doesn't seem that legislators are really willing to move these bills along very far.
In recent years, only one state has passed a law addressing the issue. In 2004, Utah began allowing faculty and students to carry concealed weapons on all of its college campuses. But the national debate continues. Both sides point to research they say illustrates that their policy would create a safer campus environment. Inside the bustling student center at Colorado State University, the majority of students seem to agree with junior William Campbell.
Personally, I think that no public institution has a right to infringe upon our rights, which allows us to carry these guns.
This is a viewpoint that students feel isn't being entirely heard by university leadership. Kirsten Silvera is a senior reporter with the school's newspaper, the Rocky Mountain Collegian.
And I think that is something that I've heard throughout my reporting.
The university's Board of Governors will meet later this month to review language on its concealed carry ban. At that meeting, they could finalize the process or decide to spend more time drafting the policy. For NPR News, I'm Grace Hood.
In the city of Baltimore, one school is trying to get children out of the classroom and into a mosque. It's the way teachers at the Friends School introduce Islam to their 8th grade social studies classes. NPR's Jamie Terabay went along on one of their yearly mini pilgrimages and sent this report.
The school bus is a tangle of North Face fleeces, Ugg boots and braces. The bus hurtles along Interstate 95 towards Washington, D.C., tossing middle schoolers about and making at least one student sick. While some of them make up songs about each other, 12-year-old Julia Potter counts off her fingers the five pillars of Islam. There's charity, prayer five times a day, the Shahada, reciting the creed.
Hajj is a holy pilgrimage to Mecca that you have to make once in your lifetime if you can afford it. And then there's Ramadan, which is a holiday where the Muslims have to fast from sunup to sundown.
Most of these kids are pretty well versed in the basics. In class, they're taught the founding of not just Islam, but Judaism, Hinduism, and Christianity. They learn about prophets, taboos, and requirements. Tilly Kornblatt knows there are different interpretations of the term jihad.
Jihad is struggling or striving in the way of God. But there's another definition. It's called holy war, and that means you can defend yourself and Islam, but you can't keep fighting when your opponent stops.
This is an annual pilgrimage of sorts for the 8th graders. Every year, teacher Dolores Jones and her colleagues attempt this field trip. And every year...
There's absolutely nothing over the years I have been able to do to keep this thing on time. It just doesn't work.
By the time they arrive at the Islamic Center in the heart of Washington, D.C., they're way behind schedule. The girls pull out bright scarves to cover their heads, giggling as they tuck each other's ponytails out of sight. Everyone takes off their shoes, and as they enter the mosaic-filled mosque, they separate. Boys sit on the left, girls on the right. It's something the kids bring up with Imam Abbasi Jarkaroma almost immediately.
The traditional way when we pray, the men will be in the front, the children in the middle, and the women at the back. So it's a tradition that is not unique to Islam, but rather that's come down through the Judaic and the Christian faith.
The room is still as the middle schoolers listen while the imam talks about the religious obligations of his faith. He says men especially are expected to come to the mosque for each prayer, but those who can't get away from work or home must pray wherever they are. The quiet, reflective mood is quickly broken as they pile out of the mosque and back onto the bus. The field trip is one way the class learns about different religions. They also have readings, lectures, role plays, and visiting speakers. Their next stop, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia.
I have to let them know we're here. We're a little late. Okay.
Through metal detectors and into an auditorium where Tariq Alagani from the Saudi Embassy plays a video, much as he does every year. It's a sweeping montage of deserts, oil fields, men at computers, and women peering through microscopes. The focus on Islam prompts a question from 11-year-old Jenna Johnson.
In the slideshow, it said that Saudi Arabia likes to help Islam. Is that the only religion in Saudi Arabia?
Well, all, you know, the land which is now called Saudi Arabia is where the religion of Islam originated.
Alagani goes into a long description of Saudi society and its inextricable connection with Islam. But as to Jenna's question, he doesn't actually answer it. The students also ask Alagani about Saudi Arabia's treatment of women.
Saudi Arabia is a very family-oriented society, and historically, women in Saudi Arabia have been housewives and homemakers. Up until the 1960s, we didn't even used to have any schools for women.
Afterwards, as the children scramble to get lunch before the trip back to Baltimore, Dolores Jones points to the obvious gaps in Alagani's answers.
He does it every year, and then we go back to school and we talk about what the truth possibly really is and how he diplomatically answered the question.
Despite those issues, Jones and her colleagues continue to bring their 8th graders here because it's the next best thing to being in the Middle East. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
We're going to spend the next few minutes on a problem college campuses have been facing for a long time now, yet the statistics continue to be chilling. A study funded by the U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 1 out of 5 college women will be sexually assaulted. Usually there's alcohol involved. NPR's investigative unit teamed up with journalists at the Center for Public Integrity for this look at how schools and the government agency that oversees them handle these cases. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
When a woman is sexually assaulted on a college campus, her most common reaction is to keep it quiet. Laura Dunn says she stayed quiet about what happened in April of 2004, her freshman year at the University of Wisconsin.
I always thought that rape was when, you know, someone got attacked by a stranger and you had to fight back.
That night, Dunn was drinking so many raspberry vodkas that they cut her off at the frat house party. Still, she knew and trusted the two men who took her back to a house. That's where she says they raped her as she passed in and out of consciousness.
I guess I didn't want to believe what actually happened.
It just didn't make sense with the way she saw her life. For one thing, she had a boyfriend. They'd been dating for 4 years.
We're getting close to marriage. We had been waiting together. And so I was still a virgin, and it just didn't fit with what I wanted my life to be and what I'd planned on my life to be. So I just kind of pushed it to the side, said, you know, this is this bad incident that happened, and it was just a mistake. You know, we were all drunk, and I just chose to, like, put it there.
She focused on her schoolwork, but she couldn't sleep. She lost weight. She broke up with her boyfriend without ever telling him about the attack. And she didn't report it. 15 months later, she was sitting in class. The professor was talking about how, in wartime, rape is used as a weapon of terror.
And this professor, who I'll forever respect, stopped the lecture and said, you know, I want to talk about rape on this campus.
The professor said that over 80% of victims stay silent.
She said, I want you to know that this has happened in my class to my students, and that there is something you can do about it, and there is someone you can talk about it with. And she told me about the dean of students, and after hearing, you know, about rape, I just decided, you know, I know it was rape, and now I know that there's something I can do about it. And so the moment that lecture let up, I walked across to the dean of students' office, and I reported that day.
We'll tell you what happened to Laura Dunn in a moment, but first, it helps to know something about the history of how colleges and universities got their current-day responsibility to investigate and prevent sexual assaults. It starts with a crime in April of 1986.
What happened to Jean was so amazingly unreal.
Connie Cleary is the mother of Jean Cleary.
She was in the right place where she should have been, in her own bed in the dorm at 6 o'clock in the morning, fast asleep. There were three automatically locking doors that should have been locked, which she thought were locked. And she didn't have an enemy in the world. And Lehigh was such a safe-looking place, you know?
Jean Cleary was 19, a freshman at Lehigh University. A stranger, he was a student, raped, tortured, and strangled her. In their grief, Connie Cleary and her husband devoted the rest of their lives to making college campuses safer.
So if it happened to Jean, it could certainly happen to somebody else. And that's why I decided I had to do something to save others from such a horror.
Connie's husband, Howard, sold his successful business to underwrite their work. Connie, who'd been terrified of speaking in public, went on TV morning shows and testified before lawmakers. Their idea was simple: force schools to disclose all crime that happens on campus. Then students and their parents would be informed, and the campus would get safer because, under public scrutiny, college presidents would have no choice but to get serious about preventing crime. 20 years ago, Congress passed that disclosure law, now known as the Jean Cleary Act. There's been success. Over a recent 10-year period, violent crime on college campuses dropped by 9%.
The Department of Education has been a disappointment to me.
But for advocates like Connie Cleary, there have been shortcomings, too. The U.S. Department of Education regulates schools under the Cleary Act, but it's fined offending schools just 6 times. And that gets us back to Laura Dunn's case. She counted on the Department of Education for help.
Dear Ms. Dunn, on August 8, 2006, the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights, received your complaint of discrimination on the basis of sex filed against the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
By the time Dunn reported to campus officials, one of the men she accused had graduated. The other said the sex was consensual. The University of Wisconsin took 9 months to investigate, then decided against punishment. As a last resort, Dunn asked the U.S. Department of Education to find that the university had failed in its responsibility to act promptly and to end the sexual harassment she faced being on campus with her alleged attacker. This anti-harassment law is among the strongest tools for enforcement at the Education Department. Few women know to use it, and when they do, the department rarely acts. Between 1998 and 2008, it ruled against just 5 universities out of 24 complaints. That's according to records obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by the Center for Public Integrity. There was no punishment in those cases, simply guidance on how to improve campus procedures. Presented with those findings, Rosalyn Alley, the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, says her office is stepping up outreach to students so they know their rights, and assistance to schools so they know their responsibilities.
We want them to get training. We want to provide some help so that the adults and the students alike can ensure that this plague, it's really become a plague in this country, begins to diminish.
The Education Department official says she's willing to take steps not used by her predecessors, to withdraw federal funding from offending schools and refer cases to the Department of Justice for possible prosecution. Laura Dunn is a teacher now. She writes the next day's lesson on the blackboard.
Most days we'll have students will be able to find interior angles of triangles.
2 years after Laura Dunn graduated, a thick document came in the mail to her apartment. It was the finding by the Department of Education.
I went straight to the conclusion.
It said the University of Wisconsin, despite taking 9 months on the case, had acted properly. Defeated, Dunn didn't read on. She threw the papers on the top of a pile of other documents in the corner of her bedroom.
You know, I could have fought it again and I could have appealed, but that would have meant I would have had to read it. And at that point in my life, just reading it, I just didn't even want to. I did not want to read the ugly things that people said.
But Laura Dunn is no longer silent. She's a leader in a national grassroots campaign to get rape survivors to speak out in public. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
To learn more about victims' rights and find resources for campus safety, visit npr.org.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Imagine a place with a lot of violent crime. Well, whatever came to mind, it probably was not a college campus. But one kind of crime is all too common there, sexual assault. NPR's investigative team collaborated with journalists at the Center for Public Integrity to examine how colleges and universities fail to protect women. And today, in the first of a two-part story, NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports on one woman who was sexually assaulted and her struggle for justice.
In a house outside Chicago, a mother goes to her closet.
This is the little costume that Margot wore.
She pulls out a small red and white dress that was her daughter's favorite years ago when she was little.
Yeah, I used to wear that all the time.
You love this.
Yeah. It's a cheerleading outfit, a little cheerleading dress from Indiana University, IU.
Yeah, she had the little, remember the little red and white pom-poms?
Yeah.
And you used to, what was your little cheer?
I don't remember.
S-U-P-E-R.
Oh, yeah. Super, super, that's what we are.
Yeah, that's what we used to do.
So when Margot grew up and it came time to choose a college, there was pressure to choose Indiana University. By then, Margot was an accomplished cellist, and her mother, Eva, who'd been a student at Indiana herself, wanted her only child to take classes at Indiana's famous music school. Now that makes Eva feel guilty. To protect the family's privacy, NPR agreed to use their first names. On a morning in April 2006, Eva was in her kitchen baking cookies. She was going to send them to Margot, who was finishing her freshman year. Then the phone rang.
I'd never heard such a desperate, just a truly desperate sound in her voice. She was just sobbing hysterically, and she kept saying, "Mom, Mom, 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 Mom," over and over, and finally I said, "Margot, please, tell me what's wrong, what's wrong?" And she said, "I've been raped."
I was laying in my bed in my dorm. I had been out of control all week and crying and just laying in bed crying, but it was like a wailing, loud cry. The girl next door would come by my room and be like, "Are you okay?" But I'm not a big crier, so when I do cry, my parents know something's really wrong.
We're telling Margot's story because what happened to her is fairly typical for the many women who are sexually assaulted on college campuses. Our investigation found that even the best intentioned of schools are ill-equipped to investigate a criminal matter like rape and then punish it. Margot was assaulted after she'd gone out drinking with friends. Her friends dropped her off at her dormitory. She'd had so much to drink that she'd had the vomit.
I think it was maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, and I can't find my keys in my own purse.
A man who lived down the hall, someone she knew but not well, approached her.
He comes over and finds the keys for me, and I'm hysterically crying, and I look horrible, you know, my nose is running and everything. He finds the keys for me in my purse and opens my door for me with them and lets me in. And I remember feeling like, oh, that's really nice of him. He's being a good person, letting me into my room.
Margot says the man then raped her in her bed as she passed in and out of consciousness. The man would say they had sex, but that it was consensual. NPR tried to contact him and his father, but they did not return our request for an interview. Officials at Indiana University also declined to be interviewed, citing student privacy laws. It's estimated that alcohol is a factor in 50 to 90% of campus rapes.
Being drunk did make a difference because I was, you know, when you're a girl and you're obviously drunk, you're putting a target on your back for a predator. So, yeah, it makes a huge difference. But what happened to me is still assault. I mean, you can't, there's a reason that's in the law that, you know, a drunk person can't consent.
Every state in the country has sexual assault laws that say when a woman is drunk to the point of passing out, she can't give consent. But local prosecutors are reluctant to take campus sexual assault cases, especially when, as is common, there was drinking or there are few or no witnesses, and it comes down largely to a woman's word against the man's. Margot's parents asked local police to prosecute. They said no. So Margot, like most other women, was forced to rely on the campus justice system. And that's not a court of law. The campus discipline system doesn't enforce criminal laws. It considers offenses of college conduct codes. Unlike criminal courts, college systems often lack the ability to collect evidence, interview subjects, and call witnesses. This stunned Margot's father, Michael. He's an entrepreneur and lawyer. And when he met with campus police, he found their approach too informal and too casual.
The police officer that had handled the case discouraged me from getting an order of protection. He said that he had interviewed the assailant and put the fear in the assailant so that he would stay away from Margot, which was not good enough.
Michael was surprised that campus police hadn't collected evidence or formally questioned the man accused of rape.
The entire system seems to be designed to make the victim go away, to pretend that the crime or incident never occurred.
When women are sexually assaulted on campus, only 5% report it. That's according to research funded by the U.S. Department of Justice. Margot was embarrassed and uncertain whether she wanted to press charges. Then she got an important email.
Hey girl, this isn't the easiest thing in the world for me to do, but it's something that I've been meaning to talk to you about.
The message came from a woman who lived just a few rooms down the hall.
He has come into my room on two occasions and has forced himself upon me both times. Both times were unwillingly on my part. He was drunk both times he came in. My door was unlocked and he took the liberty of just walking in.
The woman said she'd been able to fight off the man both times. That's one reason she didn't report those incidents. It turned out campus police were already aware of the man, who was also a freshman. He'd been arrested and charged with a felony just a few weeks after he arrived on campus. He jumped into a fight and hit a male student so hard that the young man had crashed to the sidewalk and was taken to the hospital, unconscious. Margot was scared of the man she accused of raping her, but she decided to ask the school to start a campus judicial hearing. She expected that hearing would determine the truth of what happened that night in her dorm room, and that the man she accused would get expelled.
It was a pretty, I thought, pretty black and white case. And yeah, she'd been like, all right, game over. You can't do that. Throw the book at you.
But that hearing would not go as she'd expected. Margot would end up feeling she didn't get protection or justice. We'll hear that part of the story tomorrow. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
This is NPR.